Good Monday morning. It's the day before our commercialized celebration of love, and you are tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I will be your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour. This morning, we'll pay a bit of homage to both Valentine's Day and African American History Month with a selection of classic love songs of the 20th century by African American artists. I started you off with the 1972 hit, Let's Stay Together, by Al Green. We'll also share some of Audre Lorde's thoughts on the erotic as a source of power, joy, and change, and not just between the sheets. Fran Michel reads an excerpt from her essay, Uses of the Erotic as Power. After that interlude, movie mole Jan Hocken interviews Belgian-Congolese filmmaker Genji Mutiri about his film Juwa, which concerns a troubled love between mother and son following a night of political violence that tears the family apart. The film is playing this coming Friday night as part of the 33rd Cascade Festival of African Films. We'll begin our show this morning with the love of our planet. Bill Resnick speaks with author, university lecturer, and climate activist Brian Tokar about two competing global strategies to avoid or at least mitigate climate catastrophe. Which vision is most feasible, economical, and could actually succeed within the very tight time frame we have left to stop global roasting? Here's Bill.
Hi, Brian Tokar. Welcome to KBOO.
Always good to be here, Bill.
Brian Tokar is an activist, author. He is a leader and educator of the Institute for Social Ecology in Vermont. And he's written a lot of books, among them The Green Alternative, Toward Climate Justice. His latest book is Climate Justice and Community Renewal. So, Brian, lots of folks have a hypothesis, and I agree. Now, for sure, climate change denial has become a dead letter. For sure, many people and countries are now deeply injured by drought, storms, sea level rise. And for sure, a great majority of the world's population is increasingly concerned with climate change, and they're seeking action. So the hypothesis is that the two programs have emerged, one from the left, the other from the big multinational corporations, and the rest of the big ownership class and finance. Now, in that hypothesis, it's recognized that there are many organizations that don't fit that pattern. Some left organizations are backing capital, the better to get them to take meaningful action. Some businesses would benefit from local public utilities. And for sure, neither the left nor capital have organized great conclaves, great meetings to hammer out their programs. There's no official program. But still, their intentions and their planned components are becoming clear as both take climate change seriously, both pursue their the corporations take it seriously, but want to drag out their current way of operating for a long time. But both pursue their various projects, both engage in legislative and regulatory struggles. Both are hunting and competing for state, federal, foundation grants, also venture capital investments and bank support. And as for capital, they make great greenwashing claims of promising developments, and they introduce new products. And both are seeking to find and organize allies and promote their solution. So what do you think of the hypothesis? What's your sense of the struggle?
Well, I think you're basically correct, Bill. But I think it's worth pointing out that in a lot of ways, I think there's still a spectrum of views, both on the corporate in the corporate class and among the left, on how to move forward with solutions to the climate crisis. I think you're correct that overt denialism of the climate crisis is very much on the wane, although there are certainly still elements of the right wing, especially here in the U.S., that continue to claim that climate change is a hoax and that it's just natural causes and all that sort of thing. But I think the dominant trend in the corporate world is a shift from overt denialism to trying to delay the transition as much as possible. So where capitalists do support a transition to renewable energy, it tends toward mega scale projects, some of which are incredibly destructive, maybe not comparable to something like mining the tar sands in Canada, but causing substantial damage to sensitive ecosystems, to mountaintops and ridgelines, to sensitive lands along the coast. I remember reading about a big struggle near the coast of Oaxaca in Mexico, where corporations were trying to gobble up a lot of indigenous land to build massive scale wind developments. And those are the kinds that are, of course, as I'm sure listeners would expect, the ones that are most conducive to capitalists continuing to make profits on them. The other end of the spectrum, as you've hinted at, is the smaller scale, locally controlled transitions toward renewable energy that I think most of the left supports. Although, you know, I think for those of us who have a sense of urgency about moving forward with real climate solutions, I think there's an acceptance that, at least in the short term, there will probably be a mix of smaller scale and larger scale projects. Of course, the question is, can communities retain some sense of control over some of the larger scale projects that are being proposed? I mean, we talk about things like offshore wind, which is growing at a huge pace in Europe. It's just really beginning to be talked about in a serious way here in the US. But for example, where I live in North Central Vermont, we are very concerned about protecting our sensitive habitat, including ridgelines. And ultimately, that will likely mean importing a certain amount of electricity from offshore wind turbines, say off the coast of Maine. But there are people in Maine who are raising serious concerns about its effects on the lobster fishery and other ecosystemic issues there. So, you know, there is no path to a renewable future that doesn't raise issues that are really complex. And ultimately, we have to also be very clear about the need to confront the fundamental problem of consumption. And we know that under capitalism, under an economic system that imposes patterns of continual growth and expansion and concentrated accumulation of capital, it's very difficult to talk about reducing consumption. And we have, you know, a 60, 70 year massive scale sales effort to try to convince people here in the US and in other rich countries that we need to keep buying more and more and more and more, tremendous amounts of waste. We really need to address the consumption issue really head on if we're going to move toward a genuinely renewable and sustainable future where life can continue to thrive.
Yeah, let's pursue a number of the issues you brought up. First, as to capital, in order to recognize what will be a disastrous failure of the capitalist program and, in fact, a constant increase in consumption, no firm or no industry will accept that they'll fight for their future, and none of them will accept the kinds of limits that are necessary. Each of them wants to grow. If they're not growing, they're in fact, losing out to some other firm in the industry. And all of them
they'll be bought up. Well, their assets will be liquidated. Their shareholders will revolt, etc.
Yeah, they have to keep going and keep building markets and building themselves market share, or they, if they don't, any group of executives of any company who doesn't show that group, who in fact begins losing, they're jettisoned, they're kicked out.
This dynamic of the capitalist growth imperative is why we see, for example, a lot of fossil fuel companies now starting to pay lip service to the need for a transition, but trying to delay it, trying to slow it down as much as possible. Saying, for example, oh, we know that we need to take climate change seriously, but it's not an emergency, it's not a crisis. We can take our time, we can transition slowly. And then the next stage of the substitute for overt denialism is this notion of focusing on very long-term goals. Companies say we'll be net zero by 2050. And that's still a pretty long time away. It's 30 years, which is short in the world of climate science and increasing climate threats. But it's a long time in the world of corporations. A friend of mine who's a key climate justice activist in Germany used to say, pledging to go fossil fuel free by 2050 is about the equivalent of saying we'll have colonies on Mars in 2050. Any politician or corporate spokesperson can make those kinds of claims without having to make any serious commitments. And then the whole notion of net zero is basically an accounting trick to create a scenario where at some point in the distant future, their internal operations, for the oil companies, they almost never talk about phasing out their products, but they talk about going net zero in their internal operations. And then net zero is an accounting trick where a lot of it is, a lot of their continued pollution is nominally offset by purchases of offset credits, by renewable energy credits, by interests in tropical forests and forest plantations, huge land grab in the global south in the name of so-called carbon offsets, a large proportion of which have been demonstrated to be completely fraudulent.
Yeah, and they claim they're protecting these forests, but in fact, when you add everything up, and sometimes they may in fact protect the forests, it doesn't lead to a reduction in greenhouse gas concentrations, which just keep going up and up and up, thanks to, of course, these companies.
Right.
My sense is that when people recognize, as they did in World War II, the United States, most people, in fact, wanted to stay out of the war for a very long time. They didn't want to get involved in these foreign wars and lose a lot of soldiers. The attack on Pearl Harbor really changed things. Immediately, there was support for recognize the threat to the United States of these fascist powers with world domination as their goal. It became very clear, and they accepted austerity without any question. That is, they accepted rationing. There was full employment and a period of great shared commitment in the United States. Everybody who was able in any way to work went into the workforce. The war was, of course, terrible, but for on the home front, people were supported and saw themselves. They could not buy automobiles because the factories were building tanks, and many other products were in short supply. Canned food became more of a nourishment. I think that could happen. They're going to see that, in fact, the whole world productive system is endangered and that they have to accept the period of, quote, austerity. And we don't talk about that. We talk about the other fulfillments that would be made possible even in the austerity system. People can join choirs rather than riding through the underbrush and over virgin lands as a thrill. I mean, people do change. I want to make that point that we're going to see the possibility of change and great use reduction, energy conservation, support for it, energy conservation and use reduction. So this is Bill Resnick talking to Brian Tokar for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KABU 90.7 FM Portland. So far, we've discussed the emergence of two forces, one on the left, the other corporations, and the rest of the ownership class. They're competing for the authority to direct the nations and indeed the world's response to climate change. Coming up in the interview, we compare the two and their programs as to the speed of installation, as to its cost and necessity of rapid installation, and we compare them to the cost, reliability, their impacts on democracy, participation. And indeed, in discussing the human future, we are faced with the question whether the corporate system will work at all, or will it lead to, at minimum, billions of human deaths, or perhaps the fourth great extinction, including humans. So the choice of energy system is really important. First, on valuation, let's compare, Brian, the speed of installation and why that's now so important.
Well, everything we know from contemporary climate science makes it clear that we need a very rapid phasing out and eventual elimination of greenhouse gas pollution, the vast majority of which comes from the combustion of fossil fuels. And that means we need a completely different energy system. We need to heat our homes differently. We need to get around differently. We need to run industries to the extent that we still need them in different ways than what we've come to take for granted. And we also know that fossil fuel-driven systems tend to be still far more profitable than the alternatives. So the resources need to come to a significant degree from the public sector in order to be able to accelerate this transition. We know that capitalists are able to build large-scale facilities, sometimes more quickly if the incentives exist. And if we're going to establish the kind of decentralized, locally controlled, more democratic renewable energy system that we know we need, both for technical reasons and political reasons, the public sector is going to need to jumpstart this transition. We know that in pure efficiency terms, solar and wind energy are already cheaper than fossil energy. 10 or 15 years ago, we achieved a transition point where it was clearly cheaper to build new solar and wind installations than new fossil fuel installations. Now, in 2023, in most of the world, we're at the point where it's cheaper to build new solar and wind power installations than to even keep operating, than to sustain the maintenance and fueling of fossil fuel installations. Unfortunately, that's still not good enough for the capitalists because they've got the capital invested. They're concerned about what's called the stranding of their assets, productive assets no longer being able to be usable for their full life cycle. And we know that there are still concerns that renewable energy might not prove to be as profitable. So we really need to keep pushing. It's really a political struggle to further the transition. And we need to do it in sustainable ways, but we also know that in places like here in Vermont, we can't get enough solar and wind energy without endangering some of our most important ecosystems, like the ridgelines of our mountains, which is the only place where the wind is strong enough and steady enough for wind power to be economically viable on more than a very small scale. So we'll probably need to import some of our wind energy from offshore installations on the coast of Maine. And folks in Maine have raised legitimate concerns about the ecosystem impact of those installations, the people involved in the lobster fishery, which Maine, of course, has been famous for as long as anybody can remember, are concerned about, especially the construction phase of large-scale wind installations. At the same time, we know that in Northern Europe, they're building a lot of offshore wind and are figuring out how to solve some of these problems. So the transition is going to be complex. It's going to be multifaceted, but still much of it will not be to the liking of investors who have gotten used to the vastly disproportionate profitability of fossil fuels. That's why we need to keep fighting for this transition to happen as rapidly as possible, because we're reaching climate tipping points that may be irreversible. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is telling us that the only way to avoid the most severe climate impacts is to get off fossil fuels as quickly as possible. If the world is to get off fossil fuels, say by 2050, that means that here in the wealthier countries, we need to get off fossil fuels much faster than that, because places like India are going to most likely have a significantly slower transition than we are. So we're literally talking about phasing out fossil fuel infrastructure here in the U.S. and in Western Europe and other wealthy areas in the next 8 to 10 years. We don't have a whole lot more time than that. So it's a political struggle. It's a major economic shift. Of course, we need to look at the conditions of people who work in polluting industries, the whole just transition strategy that initially evolved as an alliance between environmental justice activists and the labor movement back in the 1980s and 90s has taken an important renewed meaning as we talk about the need for a rapid energy transition. A lot of the unions involved in the fossil fuel industry are very resistant to this because they don't see the same level of wages in renewable energy that they've gotten used to in extractive industries. Indigenous peoples around the world are concerned about the impacts of mining, and we need to accelerate work toward recycling of precious metals and other materials that are still central to the renewable energy economy. There are a lot of complexities that, as a political movement, we really need to be very forthright about.
Brian Tokar, tell us a little bit about the Institute for Social Ecology and your latest book.
Yes, check out the Institute at social-ecology.org. We have a huge program of online classes that began to expand during the pandemic. Participation in those classes is very international. There's a whole new cycle starting now in mid-February, another cycle being planned for April. We're going to have our first in-person intensive since the pandemic later this spring in Detroit, and lots of other information and resources, online events. Kali Okuno from Cooperation Jackson has been hosting a series of discussions about the present and future of the climate movement that you can find on the Social Ecology YouTube channel. And my latest book is an edited collection that I worked on with Tamara Gilbertson from the Indigenous Environmental Network. It's called Climate Justice and Community Renewal. It's an international collection of writing on opposition to extractivism, resistance to false climate solutions, and community-based positive alternatives from literally all around the world. We have brilliant contributors from all over Latin America, from India, from Europe, as well as North America, and I encourage folks to check it out. It's published in 2020 by Routledge in the UK. Their prices tend to be on the high side, but they frequently post pretty good discount offers on both their print and electronic publications. So check out Climate Justice and Community Renewal, and check out social-ecology.org.
Brian Tokar, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thanks, Bill. Always a pleasure to be on the Old Mole.
That was Bill Resnick talking about alternative visions for the planet with Brian Tokar. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. Next up, Fran Michel treats us to excerpts of an important essay by Audre Lorde, which argues for the revolutionary potential of the erotic.
In recognition of Valentine's Day, here are some extracts from a classic essay by Black lesbian feminist poet Audre Lorde, Uses of the Erotic as Power. The essay was written in 1978, when feminists were critiquing and debating the pornography industry. But beyond distinguishing the pornographic and the erotic, Lorde explores here a much more expansive notion of the erotic, one which, among its other influences, helped inspire Adrienne Marie Brown's best-selling 2019 book, Pleasure Activism. Lorde's essay is worth reading in its entirety and is available in her 1984 collection, Sister Outsider. Lorde writes, There are many kinds of power, used and unused, acknowledged or otherwise. The erotic is a resource within each of us, rooted in the power of our unexpressed or unrecognized feeling. In order to perpetuate itself, every oppression must corrupt or distort those various sources of power within the culture of the oppressed that can provide energy for change. The erotic is a measure between the beginnings of our sense of self and the chaos of our strongest feelings. It is an internal sense of satisfaction to which, once we have experienced it, we know we can aspire. For having experienced the fullness of this depth of feeling and recognizing its power, in honor and self-respect, we can require no less of ourselves. The erotic is not a question only of what we do. It is a question of how acutely and fully we can feel in the doing. The aim of each thing which we do is to make our lives and the lives of our children richer and more possible. Within the celebration of the erotic in all our endeavors, my work becomes a conscious decision, a longed-for bed which I enter gratefully and from which I rise up empowered. Of course, women so empowered are dangerous, so we are taught to separate the erotic from most vital areas of our lives other than sex. And the lack of concern for the erotic root and satisfactions of our work is felt in our disaffection from so much of what we do. For instance, how often do we truly love our work, even at its most difficult? The principal horror of any system which defines the good in terms of profit rather than in terms of human need, or which defines human need to the exclusion of the psychic and emotional components of that need, the principal horror of such a system is that it robs our work of its erotic value, its erotic power and life appeal and fulfillment. Such a system reduces work to a travesty of necessities, a duty by which we earn bread or oblivion for ourselves and those we love. But this is tantamount to blinding a painter and then telling her to improve her work and to enjoy the act of painting. It is not only next to impossible, it is also profoundly cruel. The very word erotic comes from the Greek word eros, the personification of love in all its aspects, born of chaos and personifying creative power and harmony. When I speak of the erotic, then, I speak of it as an assertion of the life force, of that creative energy empowered. There are frequent attempts to equate pornography and eroticism, two diametrically opposed uses of the sexual. Because of these attempts, it has become fashionable to separate the spiritual, psychic, and emotional, from the political, to see them as contradictory or antithetical. What do you mean, a poetic revolutionary, a meditating gunrunner? In the same way, we have attempted to separate the spiritual and the erotic, thereby reducing the spiritual to a world of flattened affect, a world of the ascetic who aspires to feel nothing. But nothing is farther from the truth. The dichotomy between the spiritual and the political is also false, resulting from an incomplete attention to our erotic knowledge. For the bridge which connects them is formed by the erotic, the sensual, those physical, emotional, and psychic expressions of what is deepest and strongest and richest within each of us being shared, the passions of love in its deepest meanings. The erotic functions for me in several ways, and the first is in providing the power which comes from sharing deeply any pursuit with another person. The sharing of joy, whether physical, emotional, or intellectual, forms a bridge between the sharers, which can be the basis for understanding much of what is not shared between them, and lessens the threat of their difference. Another way in which the erotic connection functions is the open and fearless underlining of my capacity for joy. In the way my body stretches to music and opens into response, hearkening to its deepest rhythms, so every level upon which I sense also opens to the erotically satisfying experience, whether it is dancing, building a bookcase, writing a poem, examining an idea. That self-connection shared is a measure of the joy which I know myself to be capable of feeling, a reminder of my capacity for feeling. And that deep and irreplaceable knowledge of my capacity for joy comes to demand from all of my life that it be lived within the knowledge that such satisfaction is possible and does not have to be called marriage, nor God, nor an afterlife. This is one reason why the erotic is so feared and so often relegated to the bedroom alone when it is recognized at all. For once we begin to feel deeply all the aspects of our lives, we begin to demand from ourselves and from our life pursuits that they feel in accordance with that joy which we know ourselves to be capable of. Our erotic knowledge empowers us, becomes a lens through which we scrutinize all aspects of our existence, forcing us to evaluate those aspects honestly in terms of their relative meaning within our lives. And this is a grave responsibility, not to settle for the convenient, the shoddy, the conventionally expected, nor the merely safe. In touch with the erotic, I become less willing to accept powerlessness or those other supplied states of being which are not native to me, such as resignation, despair, self-effacement, depression, self-denial. Recognizing the power of the erotic within our lives can give us the energy to pursue genuine change within our world. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel, reading selections from Audre Lorde's essay, The Uses of the Erotic as Power, from her collection, Sister Outsider.
Looking out on the morning rain, I used to feel so uninspired.
That was, of course, one of the most famous love songs of the 20th century, You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman by Aretha Franklin, released in 1968. Before that, you heard Fran Michel reading from Audre Lorde's essay, Uses of the Erotic. A link to the full essay is posted on the page for this show at kboo.fm. To close our show this morning, Jan Hawkins speaks with Belgian-Congolese director Genji Mutiri about his feature film, Juwa, showing at the 33rd Cascade Festival of African Films. The film is a moving portrait of familial love in the context of political repression and violence.
Welcome to KBOO, Genji Mutiri.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me, Jane.
It is a delight to have you on the Old Mole Variety Hour this morning to talk about your feature film, Juwa, that will be screened at the Cascade Festival of African Films this Friday evening at the Hollywood Theater. And as listeners know, the Cascade Festival of African Films is an important annual event and has become an important film institution in our city. The film, released in 2022, has been widely recognized for its nuanced portrayal of a mother-son relationship. The story unfolds as they attempt to come to terms with painful memories of a traumatic night a decade prior, a traumatic event that led the mother to leave Congo, fleeing political violence and leaving her son behind. I must say, a riveting film. Genji, you are Congolese, and as I understand, you've been living in Belgium, places where the film was shot. What inspired this narrative about immigration with a tormented mother and son relationship at the center of the story?
Let's say everything I've seen and been through. As I like to say that first, I'm human, and also sometimes say I'm a Congolese Belgian, or as if I take what sometimes we hear in the United States of America, we talk about Afro-American, and sometimes in Europe you might hear Afro-European. So I wanted to tell a story with Black characters that were as nuanced and complex as the Black human beings I see around me, whether I'm in Belgium, whether I'm in Congo, or whether I'm like right now in the US. So that was the main inspiration. And then thinking about some mainly women in particular that are in my family, because I think I wanted to honor the need, not only to speak about our traumas that destroy us from inside if we don't talk about it, and also to honor the nuanced, strong and rich Black women I grew up with. So those were my main inspirations.
You're a photographer as well as a filmmaker, and I noticed in looking at some of your photography, the complex portrayals or pictures of women in your work. And I think with this story, we have both the lead character.
Yes, Riziki. She's portrayed by Baptida Saggio.
Yes, and she is both a mother and also has a political life and commitments beyond motherhood. And that's very much part of the story, is the risks she's taken and her own struggles to come to terms with her history as a political person who's taken enormous risks and the impact of that on her son. Can you speak a bit about that portrayal? Because I think it's her own divided history and suffering under political violence is part of what unfolds here.
Yes, of course. Riziki, portrayed by Baptida Saggio, is an investigative journalist in Congo. And she is also, of course, the mother of Amani, who is portrayed by Edson Anibal. And again, to come back to what I was saying about nuance portrayal of women in particular, and just human beings I see in Africa and elsewhere, it was important for me to show in the film that she is many things. She is a professional, she's a woman, she's a mother, she's a spouse, if I'm correct with my English. So it was interesting for me to show how conflicted she is, because she wants change in her country. That's why the in-depth article she's been working on put her life in danger and her family in danger. And one of the other inspirations of the script and then the filmmaking, and also talking with my whole crew, the acting team and people I worked with behind the camera, was how all those different needs and personal objectives interact and create a situation where it's going to be hard for mother and son, especially after being separated for 10 years, to understand the experience the other went through and what happened for them emotionally, intellectually, between those two moments, when they are in Congo 10 years ago and when they are reunited in Belgium. So I wanted to bring that also, because of course I was born and I grew up in Congo, which, as you hear it in the, you see it in the film, I make a little bit reference questioning how democratic that country is, even if it's called Democratic Republic of Congo. So it was also good to comment on that.
But the politics are very much kind of palpable in the periphery, but not at the center of this story. In fact, it's at some points agonizing to watch the close-up experience of both son and daughter. And you sacrifice neither in the telling of your story. Often there's the privileged point of view. To some extent, it's of the son, but also of the mother and her struggles to connect with this son and to tolerate his rage and anger at her around a sense of abandonment, and her protecting him some from what she suffered. Is part of the role, the job of a parent, is to both be honest. She says you have to speak the truth, silence will kill you, but yet she has also an investment in protecting him from the horrors of that night. And I was really struck with the sensitivity and nuances of how you portrayed the traumatic night that sets off the story and unfolds through flashbacks and memories. And, you know, you don't resort to some of the Hollywood conventions or tropes around traumatic memory. They're beautifully subtle glimpses of past scenes that felt psychologically true to me.
All right.
As well as carrying an important narrative.
Thank you very much. And thank you for mentioning that, because it was important for me not to fall in, I will call it a trap, as a, it's my first feature film. And sometimes when you're from Africa, people expect you to make kind of a postal card film. But I am, my very first website as an artist is a website called in French, L'Art d'être humain, which could be translated as The Art of Being Human. It's a poetry website. And I was like, I know intuitively that I'll make a film where we are as close as possible to those human beings. If you want to watch about your sightseeing in Congo, that's not the film. I want to really be close and tell a human story. And I love also as a photographer to observe people. So you hopefully you've experienced that emotional weight that comes with the silences that are unable to talk to each other. And that for me was only possible if you can create also with the artistic team and the great actors I work with, a sense of we're going to bring the audience as close as possible as what is going on, not only on their faces, their eyes, how they're breathing, but also try to guess the internal conflicts that they're experiencing. So that's why it was, I mean, the camera was close to them. So as also, I consume a lot of art. I learn a lot from art, no matter the form of art, you know, photography, painting, music. And I love it when I can feel something first in my guts and then later on think with my brain what happened. So usually I'm after that, whether I'm watching a play on stage or a film, I love to feel those emotions, no matter what emotion it is. So that was, I was also after, you know, I think it's Sidney Lumet who said in I think his book is called Making Movies. That's the book. So I love that book in particular, because from the introduction, he got me when he said, I will not tell you how to make movies. I'll tell you how I made my movies. And then from there, you can pick up what you need. And one of the things I needed and I used is I am the first audience of my film. Of course, it's a teamwork, but I have to, at the end of the day, be like, oh, this is the film that is as close as what I would have loved to enjoy. And for me, there's also kind of a political statement is like, hey, we have a lack of nuanced representation of about Black characters. So you are invited in this film to look at them. So I know that for instance, with the feedbacks I had, usually personal feedbacks, because in Q&A sessions, sometimes people don't want to talk about what they missed in a film, but sometimes people were like, maybe some shots linger too much on the faces. And when we were having a conversation, like a one-on-one conversation, I was like, maybe it's because I also need to look at them. It's like when even the conversation we're having right now will be richer because it's only you and I. So that's what this intimacy, whether it's intellectual, emotional or else, that's also what I want to create when the camera lingers longer on their faces so you can see how she reacts. I don't want to give any spoilers, but maybe when we'll talk after the interview, I can tell you some of my favorite scenes that has that have to do with seeing how somebody's face changes to, even if in the course of 60 seconds, you can kind of guess and see how emotionally she's going from one stage to another. And I love that. That's why I love some of my favorite filmmakers do that. I will not name filmmakers because I always forget some of them, but I love dramas that bring me in as close as possible to what the people I'm watching are experiencing emotionally.
Which I think in this film, Jawad, that it speaks to your skills as a director and the actors who we linger with because they're struggling with something important. And so it doesn't feel narcissistic or self-indulgent to linger. There's a lot going on in those moments where each of the lead protagonists is struggling with a history not of their own making, but trying to understand their own agency in that history. I would like to talk a little bit about the politics on the periphery. And as you mentioned, there's a confrontation that Amani has with both another Congolese man about what does it mean to be Congolese, and also with his mother. There's a coming to terms with her who seems very European. She's obviously doing well and has a pretty bourgeois life from the signifiers that are present. And yet Belgian Congo, as it was called, was ruled by one of the most ruthless colonial powers, King Leopold II, who's known for severing hands for those who resisted his rule. And Belgium not doing what people expected international human rights spokespeople in acknowledging that brutal history. How did you think about that history on the periphery as it set the stage? It seemed that more for a political violence not directly related to that history that becomes the event around which the story unfolds, versus this other brutal history of Belgian colonial rule.
There's so many consequences to the history of that country. What happened before colonization, during and after the dictatorship, and everything else. So that's why I'm usually interested in documentaries, because that's how I do most of my research. And as a storyteller who wants to tell, fiction stories, I have a lot of stories that will take time. So I couldn't fit everything in there, but I can already tell you that in my mind, I have a trilogy. So for me, Jua is just part one. Hopefully with the next one I start working on, I will add some more of the way political context and the political history, and more importantly, the geopolitics reality affect the collective that is all the citizens from Congo or diasporic Congolese, but also on an individual level. I thought that for Jua, I will just explore the consequences of political violence when we just look closer at a family composed of three persons. But if, I mean, ancestors willing, like I like to say, by the end of the three films I want to make, and the third one, actually, it will be like historical, because I want to start it in the 50s and tell a story that will span and go till 2025, maybe, so that hopefully, if I work well and I'm well surrounded and well advised, I can make a larger commentary on how the political history of Congo, the links with Belgium, but not only with Belgium, you know, like with the USA. If we look at what happened with the first elected prime minister, with Patrice Lumumba and the two other politicians, Polo, who were assassinated. It's not only two or three countries involved. That's what I love about studying and learning about geopolitics. It's always more. But what we can tell with a documentary is not the same for the film. So hopefully I can develop that. But I love to watch also films that then later on inspire me to go on the internet. That's why I make a little joke as well in Jua, saying that, you know, internet is kind of your best friend. So if some audience members want to learn more about the history of Congo and the link with Belgium, and why it's still, for me, there's still a lot of neocolonialism going on, even if sometimes people like to say we are post-colonial. I don't really agree with that. It's just that it's more subtle. I'm like, each audience member can use the internet and dive deeper on the subject.
Right. Yeah, there's only so much you can carry in a film. And if you're saying if it inspires more curiosity about the history, the colonial history of Congo and the Democratic Republic of Congo or DGR, the DRC, then that's a good thing. But you can't carry all of that history in one film. This is Jan Hocken talking today to Genji Mutiri, a director of Chua, a feature film that's screening at the Cascade Festival of African Films this Friday evening. Well, Genji, the tagline for the festival is African Films Through African Eyes. And you're saying that that's a complex, kaleidoscopic kind of exercise because there are so many African countries, stories, and experiences. And this is one story that you're telling through a mother-son relationship. And I think was also interesting to me in terms of your earlier point about the different levels and nuances of this mother-son relationship that spans a political trauma and their own personal relationship and attempt to connect with one another, that there's amidst this dramatic history of trauma and loss, there is a kind of Oedipal story too, in the sense of a child's discovery of the mother's love for another person that leaves the child outside of that relationship. And I'm a psychoanalytic feminist psychologist. So I'm always interested in these conflicts that are in a way part of human experience, but I think don't get recognized as part of non-Western experience, as well as part of what we recognize psychologically in Western cultures.
That's one of the subject I also wanted to explore is, I don't know who said that, but I read somewhere that's it was said, a boy becomes a man when he accepts the idea that his mother can make love to, is like loving and can make love to another man. Because sometimes it's like you there, like, my mom, she's mine. Even if, of course, there's no sexual relations involved, but it's like, if you just used to see your mother and your father and you're not mature enough psychologically and emotionally, when your mother would tell you, hey, you know what? In the best case scenario, it's like, I'm divorcing from your dad peacefully, but the son might stick to, I don't want to see my mother with another man. And so those are some of the things I wanted to sprinkle a little bit of that when Amani meets his father-in-law. And of course, I also added, because when we talk about identities, there's also skin colors. I talk sometimes with my partner, who is a Eritrean American. I'm talking about the fact that in America, there's this, I will call it a concept, I hope I'm not offending anybody, of the one drop rule. So
comes out of white supremacist thinking.
Exactly. So there's Barack Obama is black, but in Europe reality, Barack Obama is biracial. So I wanted not only to to put on top of a boy needs to grow up and be like, have this adult conversation with his mom. Of course, it's harder in the context of the traumas each of them, Amani and Riziki, experience, but it was part of my inspiration. There was also a comment about colorism or skin colors or racism within a community, because actually the father-in-law is metaphorically half black, half white.
It would be his stepfather, but so, yeah.
So there's also some issues about, okay, colorism within the community that is there with the stepfather. And the third thing that I'm sure you noticed throughout the film with Amani, there's also kind of my way to comment on toxic masculinity, because I also had to deal with it. And I see some of the younger men still dealing with it, whether they are my nephews or friends. So it was important also for me to bring that. So if I could put under the title of the Jua title or Jua film poster, I would say it's a psychological family drama. But that seemed too much.
So before we close, tell us whether you will be here on Friday night. Once again, this is Jan Hocken talking with Genji Mutori about his first feature film, Jua, that will be screened with the part of the program of the Cascade Festival of African Films, screening this Friday evening at the Hollywood Theater at 7 o'clock. Will you be there?
I mean, I will be there. I love being in the, secretly sit in the audience and feel, try to guess what they're feeling, what each one is feeling. And yes, I will be, I will of course be there and be open to either conversations at the Hollywood Theater or later on through social media, because that's the ultimate reward, is to screen this collective work we did with Jua with an audience and feel how they react. So yes, I will be there and open to any conversations, whether, like I said, on the spot or later on social media.
Well, thanks so much for your beautiful film and the what is, I think, an important film by any standards, and for joining us here as part of the Cascade Festival of African Films. And I look forward to meeting you here in the Rose City.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Okay, we'll see you Friday.
That was Jan Hocken discussing issues of love, trauma, and filmmaking with director Genji Mutori, whose film Jua plays this coming Friday at the Hollywood Theater as part of the Cascadia Festival of African Films. That does it for our show this morning. I want to thank Moles, Bill Resnick, Fran Michel, and Jan Hocken for their contributions, John Nelson for his editing assistance, and a special thanks to our guests, Brian Tokar and Genji Mutori. None of this would be possible, of course, if not for the dedicated efforts of the hardworking KBOO staff. I'm going to leave you today with one more love song, that classic tune recorded by Billie Holiday in 1934, The Very Thought of You. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay active.
The very thought of you, and I forget to do it.